Satnam, everybody.
Satnam, everyone, welcome.
Wherever you may be. So we're going to start as usual with Adhire Namah, and we'll go from there. It's Liftar Singh, I'm Guru Fateh Singh, and all right, let's Adhire Namah. Adhire Namah, Jagadhire Namah. Satkare namah, Sri Gurudeva namah, Adgare namah, Jagadgare namah, Satkare namah, Sri Gurudeva namah, Adgare namah, Jagadgare namah, Satkare namah, Sri Gurudeva namah. Thank you, Liftar. I just think some people are going to wonder, we advertised we'd have a webinar with yourself and Krishna Kaur and Guru Fateh Singh, and so they're going, some people are going to wonder what happened to those other two. They're not going to join us. They've been advised, and if you want to read their statement, you can go to my website, gurufatehsingh.com/webinar. I've posted their particular statements. But Guru Fateh Singh said he feels he doesn't want to, wants to listen rather than speak. And Krishna said specifically that the lawyers for the Sri Singh Sabha Corporation Board have told her not to speak, and Guru Fateh Singh is also a member of that board. So there are sensitive matters, and the lawyers don't want them talking. So that leaves us. And here we are. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I first met Yogi G in 1969 in, I believe it was the 1st of November. Well, there's a little more to the story. We got time. I'll get into a little bit. I met a man who had just come from meeting Yogi G back in the summer of 1969. And Yogi G had just gone to the summer solstice celebration of two or three communes that had invited him to come and teach. And one was the Hog Farm and the Juke Savages. Anyway, this guy, John, was there. And after it was over, he came to Orlando, where I grew up, to visit his father. So I come home one day, and I was in a high school band, a rock and roll band. I come home, and the phone's ringing, and I pick it up, and it's the drummer from my band, and he says, "You got to come over here and meet this guy right now. He's so cool. He's totally amazing." And I jump in the car and drive over there. And he starts telling me about this yoga and this breathing, and you get high and you never come down. And he was using drug language, which was the first step of Yogi Bhajan's genius. He spoke to us in our language of the time. And he used to say things like, "This kriya will make you feel like you're on LSD. And this kriya will make you feel like you smoked marijuana." And blue light on my glasses. I think that's from the lights. I don't see it on mine. You see blue light on my glasses? Somebody just asked.
They're psychedelic glasses, but they're cool.
It's just like Sat Kriya. It gives you blue eyes. Anyway, so he started telling me, "Oh, you get high, you never come down." And this was what I had been looking for. Like, I'd experimented with drugs a little bit. I wasn't like a drug head, but I'd taken LSD a few times. And it had shown me there was something more to the universe than what I had been taught or thought. So he just, in just about an hour, I was just in. I was like, I'm in. But between then and when I first met Yogiji was several months. And what happened was I went to college. I just graduated from high school. So I went off to college and I, the day I left for college, I decided I was never going to cut my hair again. And I was going to be a yogi. And so about 2 months in college, I guess it must have been October, one of the people in my band got busted for marijuana or something, or their parents found it. And they called all the other parents. So my parents called me and said, "Have you been taking drugs?" And I said, "Well, I did, but I'm not now. And I'm never going to cut my hair again. And I'm going to be yogi. And after being here at college and seeing how useless this stuff is, I'm not going to be in, go to school either." So that was a little much for them. And my father said, "Well, I'm going to come get you and put you in psychiatric observation, because I think you've lost your mind." And I thought about it. I was actually old enough where he couldn't do it without my permission anyway. And then, but the Vietnam War was going on, and I thought, well, maybe if I go into the observation, just act a little crazy, I can get a deferral for the draft. So I agreed to do it. So I was actually in the mental ward of our local hospital. This isn't like a real, you know, like mental hospital. It's just the normal hospital, but they have a one ward where there's a, you're there for mental observation. It's normally people who've tried to commit suicide, stuff like that. So I went in there, and I was in there and actually having a great time, met some great people, because the people in there were just, you know, they might have been depressed or had stuff like that, but they were great people. So he actually came to Orlando while I was in the mental ward, and it was 40 days. It was a 40-day observation period. So the first, he spoke two nights, he gave two lectures. And so the first night I had to escape to go see him. So I arranged for my friend to pick me up in the back of the hospital. And I sneaked down the freight elevator, went out the back. He picked me up and I went, and that's where I met Yogi Bhajan. And the first thing when he met me, he says, holds out his hand to shake my hand, and he says, "John," says, "sir, this is Liv Tarr, and this is Yogi Bhajan." And wasn't my name then, but we'll just keep it as Liv Tarr. And he shakes my hand very formally. He says, "Very nice to meet you." And I laughed, because I knew in a flash of past incarnations or whatever, and people don't understand this nowadays because we're way into this. We're 50 years into this. Yoga, Eastern thinking, bowing to the teacher, that was all really, it was something you put in a movie to get a laugh. You know, it was like a weird thing no one had heard of. So I just laughed, and I thought, you're not supposed to be shaking my hand like we're at a formal event at an embassy or something. I'm supposed to be bowing. And that all just came to me in a flash. But, you know, I just said, "Oh, very nice to meet you too, sir." And went in, had the lecture, and my friend took me back to the hospital. So the second night, the hospital called my father and they said, he snuck out and he went to see Yogi Bhajan, or my father called me or somehow he found out. So he went to see, my father went to see Yogi Bhajan the second night. I didn't go. And after it was over, my father went up to Yogi Bhajan, introduced himself, and he said, "That was my son. You know, what's your deal? What are you doing? Are you brainwashing?" He goes, he says, "Oh, yeah, Livtar, he's such a beautiful boy. He would jump off a building if I told him to." Now, I need to explain this. He would never do that. He was just messing with my father's loads and loads of preconceived notions and lifetimes of stuff. And that's a lot of what he would do. He would poke, provoke, confront, elevate. And my father never got over it in this life. I mean, he just kind of cut me off. But that's fine, because at the time he died, I was there and we went across and everything was good. It's one of the things you have to understand as we go forward. Yogiji would meet you and he would have 5 seconds, 10 seconds, 1 minute to change your arc of your destiny and the arc of your life. And that was his job as a master. And he wasn't in the role of, "Hey, I'm just a guy meeting another guy and I'm going to be polite and I'm just going to say nice things. How's the weather?" So once he goes into that role, he's got whatever time he has with you to change you. So people that are with him, some of them would get a very, very sweet and gentle and gradual, and he would gradually bring you along. Other people, he would just start jumping on you the day one, just jump on you. But a lot of people came to meet him over the years, and it was thousands and thousands and thousands of people. They only had that moment with him. So he would see his job, his role. I've got this moment to change their whole destiny. What does it take to do that? It might take a sweet word. It might take something like what he did with my father. But that's what he knew. He knew because he could see the aura. I see what you need, and he would give it. And that right there causes a lot of misunderstandings, a lot of, "Oh, I met him one time. He was so rude. I met him." Because I know of times, like we were all in Vancouver, there was a big group of us, about 40, 50 of us, and we were going to get on a ferry and go to a big gurdwara in one of the islands or something. And we got there just as they were closing the gate. And the guy running the gate who lets people in, we said, "Oh, can we get on the thing? We've got all these people waiting for us. You know, thousands of people are waiting." Guy said, "No." And Yogiji said, "Well, what about if I just go and my secretary or a couple of us go?" He said, "No, nobody can go," which was BS. I mean, it's a big giant boat and, you know, 100 more pounds of people wasn't going to matter at all. He was just being a petty little bureaucrat and wielding his power. Tsuji just lit into him. He just started yelling at him like full volume. You blah, 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 blah. So if you ever talk to that man and you said, what do you think of Yogi Bhajan? He's going to say he was a crazy, weird jerk, you know, that just screamed at me. And then if you meet someone else that, you know, 99% of the time he would be very gracious and nice and sweet and just say hello like he did to me the first time. And you meet those people and they're going to tell you, oh, he was very sweet and kind and beautiful. And it's like the old thing with the five blind men and the elephant. Like one blind man grabs the trunk and he says, oh, the elephant's like a snake. And one blind man grabs the leg and he says, no, the elephant is like a tree. And it's whatever you were shown is what you get out of it. So, especially when you hear things about Yogi Bhajan, that's the number one thing. What was that person getting from him that they needed to get from him? What was their perception of what they got from him? And that totally depends on you, how you were brought up, what mood you were in that day. I know of cases where he would tell a husband, like, my wife's real this or that, and he'd say, well, you have to be tough with her because her father was wimpy, and if you're wimpy, she'll see her father and then she'll do all that. And then other times I've seen where he said, no, this girl was abused. You have to be absolutely sweet to her every moment of every day. You cannot say one cross word. So it was absolutely, totally by their aura, by their destiny, and by what they were supposed to get. So back to how I met him. After the second night that he spoke, he went down to West Palm Beach, Florida, and there was a big pop festival, music festival like Woodstock. And I broke out again. I had my friend come pick me up. This time I didn't wear my shoes because I knew they were watching me. So I thought, well, if I'm barefoot, they won't think I'm leaving. So I went out at the back again. We drove down. It's about a 4-hour drive. We had about 50 cents, I think, enough to buy one thing of popcorn to share between us to eat. We had nowhere to stay. We slept. And it was drizzling rain and it was cold. And we slept by sitting in crow pose, which is squatting. We just squatted and leaned up against a pole underneath the bleachers, the seats that they had, and slept squatting in the rain so that we could see him speak for 10 minutes the next day. And that's the kind of hunger we had for that spirituality and that, what our souls were hungry for. So after all this happened, what happened for the mental ward, they called my father in at the end for the consultation. We sit down and my dad says, okay, what'd you find out? He goes, he's the most well-adjusted boy I've ever met in my life. And you could just see my father kind of deflate, like, oh, I was hoping something was wrong so we could fix it. So I go home for about a week. Everything's really uncomfortable. And finally, my mother says, I'm going to the beauty parlor. When I get back, either have your hair cut or be out of here. So I put 3 shirts, 2 pairs of pants into a pillowcase, threw it over my shoulder, and I just walked out the door. I had no idea where I was going, no idea what I would do. It's like, all right, it's the challenge. God will take care of it. So one of my brothers had overheard it, and he picked me up like a mile down the road. He got in the car and came and got me and took me over to Huddy Singh and Huddy Kaur. Huddy Singh just passed away a couple of years ago. A lot of people know him. He was the family Yogiji had stayed with. And so I went to his house. We called Yogiji and he said, come to LA and I'll teach you here. So I went to LA in January of 70 and stayed there 6 months. Then he sent me to Atlanta to start the ashram, and that's, I've been here ever since. Now, we got time for some story, right?
I mean, well, I agree. Yeah, yeah. You want to tell them how you got? I mean, this is so much time has passed. People are not going to understand how you got there unless you tell them how you got back.
How I got to LA? Yeah, I mean, I tell this story because it's like the Odyssey, or it's almost like a fable. The way everything was laid in front of me. And so I left home and I hitchhiked back up to Florida State, which is where I had gone to college for that month or two. And that's Tallahassee, Florida, up in the north of Florida. And then I was going to go head west from there, because Interstate 10 is a highway that goes all the way from Florida to LA. So I decided, I'd never been out of west of Alabama, so I thought I'd see the country. So I got a train ticket to, I think, El Paso or somewhere in Texas, and then I hitchhiked. So I get on the train, start going, and there's these two beautiful hippie girls. And by then my hair was getting good. I was getting a little beard and my hair was getting kind of long and I looked pretty cool, hippie wise. And these girls, they're like my age, 18, whatever. And they're just telling me, so I live in Hawaii and we have this kind of commune on the beach. And we just lay on the beach and we pick the mango trees off the trees and eat them. And we smoke marijuana and we just pass our days in this blissful world of the senses. And I'm part of the package. Like she's just offering herself. So they're like, "Ooh, come with us, come with us. Don't go to LA, come with us to Hawaii." And I had probably just enough money to get to Hawaii one way. So I would have gotten there and never been able to get back. So the train ride was this Maya, like, "No, you don't really want to do this. Please, no, 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 come with us." So in my mind, I said, I've had, because I'd already learned some things, you know, I'd been taking lessons with John and learned from Yogiji when I met him. And I knew about reincarnation and that there's millions of incarnations to get to the point where you find a spiritual teacher, recognize your spiritual teacher and stick with your spiritual teacher. So in my mind, I said, well, I've spent millions of lifetimes, and I bet you a bunch of them, I was on a beach as a bug, as a those little birds that run along the beach, as a fish, as a lizard. I mean, I bet I've been on the beach thousands or millions of incarnations. I don't need to go on the beach. So just what I had learned already, it then saved me. So then I get out at Texas, went to a Motel 6. And in America, we have this motel chain called Motel 6. And no one knows anymore. The reason it was called Motel 6 is it was $6 for a room. And I got a room for $6. Stayed over one night, took a shower. Got up the next morning, I started hitchhiking to go to the rest of the way to LA. And the last ride I got was this firebrand, young revolutionary, tear everything down and start the revolution. And he said, what are you doing? Where are you going? I said, I'm going to LA to study yoga with Yogi Bhajan. He goes, that's not where it's at, man. You need to be out in the street. You need to be doing politics. And I only had to think about that one for about 12 seconds. No, thank you. I know what I want to do. So we pull into LA at 11 at night. And again, for the people who have never been to Los Angeles, Los Angeles is about 40 miles across, I think, and even more if you just add in all the little communities that kind of blended in as LA spread out and became bigger and bigger. So it's really just one big continuous city for just miles, 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 miles. And I had no idea because I grew up in Orlando before Disney came to Orlando, and it was just a nice little town, maybe 60,000 people. I don't know, just really nice little place to grow up. And I had no idea of that kind of scale. So he said, where are you going? And I didn't even have an address. He said, I said, I'll just tell you when to let me off. So we're coming into LA on the freeway, and it's 9:30. No, it's 11 at night. There's a lot of traffic. I said, wow, there must be some big event going on. I just wasn't used to big cities have traffic all the time. So I just said, okay, next exit. Just pull off here and let me off. So we go down the bottom of an exit. There's a 7-Eleven down there at the bottom of the exit. And I get out and I call the ashram because I do have a phone number. And this isn't the main ashram where Yogiji teaches. This is a live-in ashram. I call the ashram. I said, hey, I'm here. And they said, where are you? And I said, I'm at the corner of Beverly and I-10, I guess, whatever. He said, oh, you're only 3 blocks away. Now, what are the odds? I mean, there are no odds. That's just stupid. That's not even, because I had no idea. I could have ended up 20 miles away. So I walked up the 3 blocks, knocked on the door. They greeted me, hey, come on in. And said, here's where you're sleeping. They took me into the hallway. This is another feature of our early days. We would have these ashrams. Everybody would just come pile into a house. And normally the women would get the bedrooms and the men would just sleep around, sleep in the sauna room, sleep in the hallway. So me and one other guy were in the hallway. And so I probably got to bed at 11:30 or 12. 2 a.m., there was a guy in my face.
Wake up!
And that was the wake up for real and wake up in your life. And that was how it started in LA. And we just started from then on. 1 hour a day of yoga. I mean, every morning, hour of yoga, 2.5 hours long ekonkars. Now, within 2 months, I started seeing what I think everybody calls it, the blue pearl. No one knew what it was back then when I was asking people. Anyway, when I would close my eyes and start doing long ekonkars in about 5 to 10 minutes, this little blue, bluish white pearlescent orb that looked like a pearl hanging in front of you on a string about 5 or 6 feet in front of me. But it was inside in the third eye. And it would just be there. It wouldn't like come and go or flash. It would be there. And if I moved my eyes from right to left, the pearl would stay in the same place as if it was a physical object hanging in space. So I would just watch and stare at this blue pearl while I did the long ekonkars. In another month or two, somebody showed me this set of exercises that raise your kundalini. And it's just three minute exercises. Sit on your heels and do full spine flex. I can't even remember it now. I don't even know if I wrote it down. Anyways, just three kind of standard things. And then you lay down on your back and you do the long ekonkar mantra mentally, and you merge it into the sound current. Now, if you haven't learned what sound current is, or it's what we call the ringing in our ears, there's always a constant sound going in your head, and you know, we call it the ringing in the ears, but it's actually the sound of the universe. And it's so you lay down, you tune into that sound, you merge the mantra mentally into that sound like it's a river. And then I would wake up in this sound like a million bees. And then I would start rushing up like I'm on a rocket ship launching into space, and this incredible upward rushing feeling. And I was raising my kundalini. So I had the blue pearl. My kundalini was going up at will. I actually only did it like 2 or 3 times because it was so gnarly. It was like riding a roller coaster, but instead of putting you in the seat, they make you hold on to the bar with your hands and hang on the outside. I mean, it was kind of gnarly. Anyway, the reason I'm telling you all this . What Yogiji brought was real, the real thing. It really works. It's 1, 2, 3 ABC. It just works. It's a living entity in and of itself. Another thing people don't realize: oh, the teachings are this set written down in a book. No, they're an entity that lives in the fabric of the universe, in the ethers. And if it's your destiny, you get to tap into it. And you tap into it through a teacher. And that teacher is your channel. That teacher is everything. So that's how I met Yogiji.
Waheguru. Waheguru. And you hitchhiked back and started your ashram. You have so many stories. You could spend time just doing stories. Our day, hypothetically, is dedicated to the genius of Yogi Bhajan. So clearly, without his genius, none of this, what you just described, would happen. I mean, he came, he was a Punjabi Sikh. He could have just pretty much kept his cultural blinkers on and said, yeah, who are these kids, you know? Where are my people? Where are my Punjabis? And hung with them and not related to us at all. But that's not what he did. You could say his example goes right back to Guru Nanak, who sought out people who were different and shared with them the knowledge of Satna. And Satna means basically, we talked about this a couple of webinars ago, it means basically be yourself, you know, be authentic, which is easy to say, but really you have to go under layers and layers of superficiality. Even our word person, you know, persona means mask. So you got to take off all those masks and find that three-year-old inside of you, that joyful, Jesus said, unless you be like a child, you're not going anyplace. You're not going to heaven. Forget it. So that's what Guru Nanak was teaching. That's what Yogiji was teaching. And we were totally there because we were totally not about growing up. Totally. We could see, you don't trust anybody over 30. And we had these songs, Hope I Die Before I Get Old and, all that stuff. And hopefully we haven't got old yet. Some would say we have. But it's a matter of consciousness. And that's what Yogiji was teaching. He's giving us the methodology, which to my understanding, a lot of folks who are very, close with Guru Nanak, who love Guru Nanak, haven't tapped into that methodology that he talks about in the Sit Ghosh, in his dialogue with the yogis about how to physically integrate Satnam in your life. So you radiate that and so the joy is with you and Kele Sagal Jagat. Indeed, everything is play. Everything is playful. And you're having a good time. Or as Yogiji would say, Ketya Duk Buksat Mar Ebi Da Teri Da Tar. Again, quoting Guru Nanak. So, whatever bad happens to me, that's all a gift. It's just par for the course. It's something to play around with. It's something to have fun. Otherwise, life is boring. So bring on the hard times. It's just fun. We're equipped. We can deal with it. And so that's what Yogiji did. He came out and I remember I was a young man. My dad was Russian. No, he was German, but he fought in Russia. And with all the atrocities that he saw there, he didn't want to go to church anymore. My mom, she grew up in a small South German town. She wanted to go. So I would go every second Sunday, go to Sunday school. I missed I wasn't very good in Sunday school, but I really enjoyed my weekends, my Sundays staying at home, reading comics in my bed, like wearing my pajamas. And little I knew that, I would get my wish to wear pajamas because that's what they call them. This is what I'm wearing today. They call it pajama, kurta pajama. So I got my wish. I wear cotton fiber. I wear pajamas, and you call it a joke, but there was something deep inside of me. Didn't want to go to church. Didn't want to conform, do it all the adults, those adult people we call adults, all those adulterated people do. But I, for all reading the books of wisdom I could find, I couldn't find a role model. And so I felt so blessed. I found Yogiji as a role model. And he was going way beyond what might be expected of a conventional Sikh or even a conventional yoga teacher. He would say, don't follow me, don't bow at my feet, be better than me, be 10 times greater than me. There's nobody else was saying that. I mean, that's revolution. And that's huge. And I recognize that integrity. And I was so grateful, so grateful. And, Satnam, part of being yourself And this needs to be better articulated. You know, it's not in the scientific literature. You know, it's what we worship as a culture here, the scientific literature. But, you know, intrinsic being, you know, being yourself also means being comfortable in your skin, being comfortable in your body. And as hippies, we got that. You know, our minds were totally, you know, a lot of the garbage went out. And, you know, taking psychedelics has its issues. I couldn't read, really. I couldn't concentrate for a couple of years. But I got it. And even before psychedelics, I realized that culture twists us. You know, it makes us very insular. So it's like the Tower of Babel, you know? So you got somebody babbling here, somebody babbling there. Russians don't get along with Ukrainians. Ukrainians don't like Belarusians. Belarusians don't like the Poles. Nope. Nobody likes anybody very much. But, you know, to be a child and to get rid of those blinkers, that's the universal spirit that that Yogaji taught us. And that's, you know, Kundalini yoga, as Yogaji taught it, is a universal message to inspire all of us to be our best. And it's a methodology, a physical methodology to do that and to get there. And that's what Yogaji taught us, to bring in an Aquarian age. We're thinking of genius. Liptar, I'll tell a little bit and then you can tell a little more. The story of how Yogaji married, you know, astrology. We had our astrologer Satsiri yesterday speaking, but married astrology and his mission. And so as it happened, you know, Yogaji, I mean, all these coincidences, Liptar gets dropped off 3 blocks from the ashram. I mean, it's all destiny. But look at this, Yogaji, and again, read the biography. If you want all the details, we're not going to read the biography. We don't have time. But you can go there on your own time, read it. Maybe one day we'll have an audiobook. But, you know, he spent his first couple of months teaching with a lady, Dr. Judith Tyberg, who was a scholar. She would bring in yogis, but they had a falling out because she was just so intellectual, and the students who were coming around were hippies. And so her usual following didn't care for the hippies. It was a culture clash, and he had to make a choice. So he joined the hippies, and he needed a new sponsor, because Tyberg was sponsoring him getting his green card. And so his host he was staying at, knew a lot of the celebs, the musicians, the actors, the actresses, and found a guy called Johnny Rivers. So Johnny Rivers became his sponsor. Just met him once, I think, and they got on. You know, Johnny Rivers was a musician. He had a few number one hits. He also had his own record label. And look at the destiny, how it happened. So he has a record label, and he has this group, this Afro-American group, and they said this big hit, Up, Up, and Away, My Beautiful Blue. You can Google all this stuff. But just then, there was the year before, I think, or maybe two, there was a musical called Hair. It was a peace musical. It was a hippie musical. That's nude scenes. It was, you know, a little bit radical. It was on Broadway. And so Johnny Rivers, I think he went to Broadway, or one of his workers went to Broadway looking for material, and they found this beautiful song, a song called Aquarius. And so he got his group called The Fifth Dimension to sing the song, and it just came out just shortly after Johnny Rivers sponsored Yogaji. Just shortly after it came out, it was released. My God, that song, it was a huge hit. It was number 2, I think, after Sugar Sugar. You want to check it for the year. It was some bubblegum rock, which some people, I don't know where their brains were. But that was the number 1 hit of that year, I think, Sugar Sugar. But number 2 was Aquarius, and it was on the top of the charts for about 8 weeks. All around the world, people were singing that song. And it made a lot of money, and it was a very positive song. And Yogaji picked up on that. Very easily, he picked up on that positivity, and he married his message and the song. And he said, you know, Guru Nanak, my guru, he's a guru for the Aquarian age. And it stuck. And a few months later, he had one of his students who could write a book about Guru Nanak. She's since gone a different direction. She's gone to the dark side, I would say. But she left some really nice works, and this beautiful book, Guru for the Aquarian Age, it's still published. And that's what he called it. You go to Punjab, ask about the Aquarian Age, nobody's going to get it. You know, that's not a Punjabi message, but he catered that message to us, much as the the Jesuits, they came to China in the 1600s, and they tailored Christianity to a degree to the Chinese, and used Chinese symbolism and Chinese imagery to convey their message. That's what a good teacher does. And he did just exactly that. And I think, Liptard, you have a song about the age of Aquarius and Johnny Rivers. You shared it on Facebook. You want to share that?
Yeah. Oh, you mean the when that happened?
Yeah.
It was just one day in class there in L.A. This would have been first half of 1970. And Johnny Rivers was at class, and after it was over, he said, "Hey, Johnny, play the song." And so he started singing it. We were all singing, and then he'd say, "Okay, all the women sing. Now the men sing," and we did this whole big thing, and Yogiji was just totally loving it. And this is more of that thing about how he used to talk to us in the language, in our language, in our drug language. At the beginning, he used our language that we understood. He didn't come and, "I'm a yogi and take it or leave it, I'll talk to you." He came to our level, he talked to us to get us. And the other side of this, in India, you didn't do this. In India, you went to the teacher 100% humble before you even got your foot in the door. He didn't come to your level at all for anything. So he came and he just flipped everything on his head. He said, "All right, I'm going to go. I'm going to go with them and I'm going to pull them with me up. I'm not going to be from on high and looking down and telling them." And to me, that's number one on the genius list. And, you know, it's the kind of thing you don't realize till years later. Like, I didn't realize a lot of this till I went to India and I just understood a lot more about how it worked. Because at the beginning, you're just, "Oh, I just met him and that's how he is." You know, it's like, that's just what's going on in the moment. I didn't have any perspective on it. That all came later. And who would have just been able to, from his excellence of consciousness, all of the training he had gone through. And if you haven't read the biography that Grifuta keeps talking about, you've got to read that. It's to understand him, to understand his training, his caliber, what he went through, why there's not another one. Like, who could do that? I mean, I'll tell you a little story. I was sitting with another teacher who was the head of an ashram for many years. And we were both remarking about how Yogiji handles the number of people that he handled coming to him day in and day out and staying for all just different kinds of periods of time in different roles. Like, somebody would come and he'd say, "Oh, what, you can be on my staff." And somebody else comes and all they do is ever meet him for 5 minutes and then that's it. And some would come and move into the ashram, and some would come and stay in their own home in town but come to all the classes. Just every level of interaction, every level of mental stability and need, and in some cases psychosis. And he just handled one thing right after another, handled it. And all these people looking to him as their teacher. Now, I was the head of an ashram for years and years, decades, and this other guy was too. And so we had dealt with a lot of the stuff that we're talking about. We dealt with people's stuff, people's father phobias and mother phobias and all the stuff they bring. And it kind of just freaks us out. We're like, you know, we were the head of the ashram because that's what he gave us to do. You couldn't pay me to do it. Otherwise, I wouldn't do it. This is nuts. Who does this? But he did it. He did it on a scale like 100 times. And so what we're saying is, if somebody came to you and said, sir, I'm turning my whole life over to you, and I'm going to do whatever you tell me. And I, both of us were just, oh, hell no. I don't want the hassle. I don't want the responsibility. That's what he did all day long. And so the other guy told me this story, and he said, one of his students came to him and she said, well, I got diagnosed with cancer. What should I do? And he gave her a healing meditation, probably Rama Dasa Sase Soham. Nothing super amazing or anything. Well, to us, it's not super amazing. And it's not like, oh, he went into some samadhi and brought her a special thing. He just gave her the healing meditation that we've all learned. So she goes and does it for a couple of months and probably did other things. I don't know. She might have changed her diet. Comes back 3 months later and says, cancer's completely gone. I'm completely healed. And you are now my teacher. And I'm your student. And I'm going to sit here all day long and be your student and do whatever you tell me. He said, oh, hell no. I am not taking that. I don't want that. You're fine. Guru Ram Dass did it. Don't worry about it. Everything's good. It's a freaky thing to even think of one student that depends on you like that. What he did, it's impossible. I don't even know how he did it. I'm flabbergasted, in awe. There's no words. There's no nothing for what he did. And one of the funniest things I ever read, I'll read people say, well, if he was such a great yogi, why was he sick and why did he die? Because he was done. If you think the purpose of life is to squeeze one extra day out of life, I can't help you. If you think the purpose of life is to finish your karma and be done, then let's talk. But he went, he gave everything, 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 every minute, every second. I would be on trips with him. We would travel. We used to have this setup where there were regional directors. So I was the regional director of the Southeast United States and in the Caribbean, the islands. And so a lot of times for a few years, we would travel to Trinidad and Puerto Rico. And sometimes one year we went down to Venezuela. What he would do, we would get where we were going, and then he would start looking for people to go and meet and help. So instead of like when most people travel, they get where they're going, they say, okay, let's get to the hotel or wherever we're staying, let's get settled, rest, and then whatever. One year we came in from Puerto Rico, and it was right before winter solstice. So we came in from Puerto Rico to Miami. And every hour a plane left from Miami to Orlando, it's kind of like a shuttle. you could just go get in line and get on. This was years before the way they have it now. It was kind of like an open ticket. We get in at 2 p.m. And this was also back before you couldn't go down to the gate at the airport. So local people would come and meet him at the airport. So we come in at 2 p.m. and he sits there and people come to visit. And we say, sir, the next plane leaves at 3. Okay. He sits and talks, blah, blah, blah. Sir, the next plane's at 4. Okay. Blah, 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 blah. He's talking to people. Sir, the next plane leaves at 5. Blah, 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 blah. This is sitting in the airport. This is not comfortable. 5, 6, 7, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. Finally, the last plane that leaves for the night is at 11. We say, sir, if we don't get on this plane, we aren't going to make it. He said, all right, we'll get on this plane. And there's a bunch of people that couldn't get on the plane before. They were all waiting. So he said, Liftar, get out your guitar and play them some music. So I was playing a little concert for all the passengers there in the waiting room. So we get in. It takes, well, probably till midnight. It's not a very long flight, but you know, the time it takes to taxi. And then it takes half an hour for luggage. And then by the time we get to the ashram, it's 1 or 1:30 in the morning. He did not care about comfort. He did not care about what you're supposed to do. He cared about sharing himself, sharing what he had to share, sharing the teachings at great cost to his health, his energy, and whatever else. I've been with him in India traveling. And we'd just, everybody jump in the car. So like 20 of us would jump in 3 or 4 cars, take off into the countryside, go to some little gurdwara. And then he would sit and talk with everybody for an hour, jump in the car. And then we'd drive for another hour to another little gurdwara, sit and talk with everybody. And just do that all day long till 10, 11, 12 at night. And then get up in the morning and go do the Seva at the Golden Temple, cleaning the floors of the Golden Temple. He just didn't, he wasn't here to take his time and rest and do all that. He was here to get finished, to spread what he had to spread, and then done, home, job well done.
Vaheguru. Yeah. You know, I got it kind of early. I realized, you know, we're all mortal. I mean, I studied that kind of stuff before I left home, reading the philosophers. Death is on your left shoulder. So when the 80s, the yogis started having health issues, I had a sadhana of writing him every month. And that was, I realized that was a strain on him. And there were other things going on as well. I mean, frankly, I mean, there were things going on in Toronto. I had such a close connection with him. People said, oh, well, maybe Gurupada Singh is angling to be the head of the ashram, or maybe he's eligible for that. But I didn't want that. I didn't want that. And so I had two reasons to cut off my monthly communications with Yogiji. One, I didn't want this responsibility to be in charge of this ashram. He'd already given me the job of writing his biography. There's plenty to do. And we just had a child came to us shortly after that to raise. And so I didn't want to put pressure on him. He had operations and wasn't traveling, blah, blah, blah. So I quit writing him for a few years and focused on that. And I started to say, you know, he's going to be gone one day. And I said, you know, good training for me to develop my subtle connection with Yogiji. Even writing it is not that subtle. I'm getting a letter back. So I started doing that in the middle 80s. I said, and he would keep telling me, like in the 70s, saying, well, I could be gone anytime now. Get ready, you know? And so I started taking it seriously. And I said
that since 1972, by the way.
and he was right. You know, we can say that too. Eventually it becomes very true. We're all goners one day. But, you know, some of us didn't want to really take that, didn't want to accept that. We wanted to hold his hand forever. But I feel very blessed that I was able to do that. And in writing his biography, you know, though I'm German by, background, and we have a natural suspicion of charismatic leaders, you know, well-earned, I started to really appreciate his work. And toward the end, after I'd written the biography and submitted it and written background works, I wrote one book about, which is basically a history of the Aquarian Age, which I submitted to him. And most specifically, there's an area that I wanted to really put down on paper, put down for people to read and understand. I wanted to do a book on the common ground between yoga and Sikh Dharma, which Yogi Bhajan uniquely held that space. There was nobody else on the planet holding that space. So I wanted to write a book about it. And I felt very blessed. I lived in gurdwaras. You know, the gurdwaras, some of them were very gracious and just gave me space. They didn't know what I was doing, but they trusted me. I worked a little bit with their children, so trade-off. But so when I finished that book, you know, I wanted to send that to Yogiji. And I did send that to Yogiji as a kind of a message to say, you know what, Yogiji, you've done so much. You've taught us so much, and we get it. You know, I get it. And I put it in the book so anybody can get it. You know, I know you're in a lot of pain. You know, your job, you know, for heaven's sake, maybe you've seen some of his videos giving the Japji courses in his last days. The man was in such pain. You know, he had a thing up his nose, and he just kept soldiering on. And I just wrote him a letter and said, here at City Singside, you know, we got it. You call yourself a mailman. You delivered the mail. You got the mail. You don't have to live to 108. We're not that dumb, you know. We got it, and it's compiled, and people can read it. And thank you from the bottom of our hearts. And so, yeah, he doesn't have to be that 200-year-old yogi. He told us once, there's a story of somebody came to him and said, have you seen the picture of our guru? And he said, what guru? And he showed him the picture. He said, you know, the guru, he lived 400 years. And Yogi said, you know, Yogi, somebody who lives that long, God doesn't want to see them, you know? That's a disgrace that somebody's hanging around that long.
What's wrong? God didn't want him back?
Yeah, I think it's something like what he said. So, yeah. I mean, definitely. He definitely worked so hard, worked his body to pieces. The doctors had him on... restrictions for the last 10, 15 years of his life. Don't travel, don't do this, don't do that. Well, a lot of them, he went against doctor's orders anyways, because he didn't care. He just wanted to get the message out. And, whether we're really appreciating that or whether we were just in it for the good times, you know, that, time will tell, right? You know, somebody, Liptar asked to hear the story about how you wrote a song in Tulsa. Can you share that?
Yes, I can tell. There's one thing I want to... All right, I'll do that first. Song of the Khalsa. It was 1975. So the thing I was really meditating on and try to bring into absorb was the concept of courage, fearlessness, deathlessness. Because when you first, whatever you come from, whatever life you come from, unless you're brought up in this as a Khalsa and you hear these stories, but we were brought up in the West with just whatever normal stories. So there's a process you go through of hearing it and then absorbing it and then integrating it to where it becomes real instead of just an intellectual concept. So I was meditating on courage, fearlessness, And I just happened to go to this movie. And the movie is called The Human Factor, starring George Kennedy. And various people have looked it up over the years, and they watch it and they go, well, I kind of see how you got that, but not really. But so it was like this moment where I had this meditative thing in the front of my brain and I saw this movie. So in the movie, this guy, he's living in Europe and he comes home from work. He's an American working for a large corporation and he's living in Europe, comes home and these terrorists have murdered his family. And he's just this mild-mannered man. He doesn't know anything about fighting or weapons or anything. He's just a computer guy. And so the police start looking for him, and then they keep doing other atrocities. And he just gets really pissed off, and he just determines he's going to get him because the police can't seem to get ahead of him or find him. So he uses computer skills or something. And he figures out where they're going to be. So what they do is they take over about 10 of them go into a grocery store on a U.S. Army base right when it opens. And they wait till there's about 15 or 20 people in there. And they pull out guns and then they start holding everybody hostage. So they've got a bunch of hostages in a grocery store. And so the Army, because it's on an Army base, the Army lines up all the Army outside, but they can't do anything because they don't want the terrorists to start shooting. So they're all lined up and they got tanks and every weapon in the world. And he just comes with his car, jumps over their line somehow, you know, movie stuff, and crashes through the front window of the grocery store, gets out and just starts shooting them. And there's a whole scene, you know, where he's shooting them. And one of the terrorists he shot falls dead and the gun's laying there. And one of the women picks up the gun and shoots one of the terrorists who had the drop on the hero. So his heroism, not only was him being fearless, but he was inspiring others to do things they wouldn't normally do. And I just got this thing about, oh, that's what it means to be fearless. You don't care about what happens. It isn't that you don't care, like, you know, I want to commit suicide. I don't care. It's this thing, this job, this thing has to be done. And what happens to me is a very secondary thing. So it becomes secondary to the mission. And I came home and I was just thinking, man, if I could just bottle this moment of understanding I have, this like flash of inspiration or getting it. And so I took out my guitar and I started writing the chorus and then the verses. And a lot of times I'll take a long time to write a song. My longest is I started the song in 1976 and finished it in 2015. But a lot of them would be months or a year where I would just get an idea and I would just let it sit. This just started coming out right there on the spot. And I had four verses done, chorus. It's like, yeah, I think this gets my, gets it across. I think it's good. And then I went upstairs and I was going to Preetkar says her audio is too low, but I think it must be on her end. So I'm hearing you okay. I went upstairs. I was just going to lay down and rest. So as I walk through the doorway, right in the door of the of my bedroom, right in the door frame, I feel a physical, somebody knocking on my head like you knock on a door. So before this part, I got to tell you, we were so yogically accomplished, like seeing non-human entities and just having experiences beyond the earth. This didn't even seem unusual to me, and it didn't even impress me. So when the knocking came on my head, I was kind of irritated. I went, what? Instead of, wow, some non-human entity is trying to get my attention. And this voice says, it's not finished. And I say, of course it's finished. It's not finished. Yeah, it says everything I want to say. Go finish it. It has four verses. It's finished. That's my favorite line. Like, how many verses is what really matters? And the voice goes, go finish it. And like a little three-year-old kid, I go, okay, I'll go finish it. So I go back downstairs, go in the sun room, I pick up my guitar. And it's just waiting. It's just there, right there. And it just comes right out, the next verse. And it's Baisakhi Day, we were thousands, only five had the courage for dying, which became the fourth verse. I stuck it in as number four. And Yogiji heard that. Well, another quick story. That was in like October or November 75. So we went to winter solstice, and we would have winter solstice at this camp. And the camp was like a Boy Scout camp, and it had cabins. And Yogiji's cabin, we would take turns guarding it. And so I was on duty out front, and I brought my guitar, and I was going to play him this song. He had never heard it. And so I'm out there just putting little finishing touches, making sure it's right. And Baba Singh comes out of the cabin and he says, Liftar. I said, yeah. And he said, Yogiji wants you to stop that noise right this second. And I just deflated like a balloon because I thought he heard the song and didn't like it at all. So I never was even going to play it for him. And I didn't play it for him. And it just so happened, I did play it one night at the winter solstice, because we used to play from evening entertainment. Everyone would come at the same time. We used to do everything together. So I played it one night, and Gurshavid Singh and Flowers in the Rain, Mental Block, you know.
Gurdas Singh.
They somehow learned it. I guess I played it for them once or twice, and they learned it. So they played it for him at the Baisakhi in that next spring in L.A., and then he just said, oh, well, you know, okay. now this has to be played in every gurdwara from now on. And I don't know what the lesson is there, but it's just a funny story to me. So the reason I wrote it was back in 1971 at summer solstice, we had the solstice on somebody's farm, and the deal was that we could use the farm to have the solstice as long as we helped the people who live there with their crops. So every day for a couple hours every morning, a whole bunch of people would just go down into the fields and help do weeding and whatever they were doing. And they had this big farm truck with a big flat on the back. And then instead of sides, it had wooden posts with the wooden posts that go across. So it made a lattice. And Yogiji said he saw the truck full of people being taken down to the farm, and he had this image. And he said, someday we'll be taken away in trucks like this to be killed. And we'll be singing, may the long time sun shine upon you as we go to be killed. And ever since he said that, I always thought, that's a nice song, but I'd like something with a little more oomph if I'm being taken to be killed. And so that was the genesis of the thought process that brought that kind of, what song would I want to be singing when I'm being taken away to be killed? So that's where that came from.
Vaheguru. You know, I've got a list. I think we'll take an intermission in about 10 minutes. And after that, I'll run through the whole list of things that I think are genius. There's a lot of them that Yogi did in one lifetime. Typical person, if they do one of these things, whoa, they get a Wikipedia article. But there's a lot here. One of the items is his interaction with, not only has he made his own art, his own poetry and drawings, but his interaction with artists, visual artists and the musicians. Do you want to share anything about, aside from what we were just saying, any other stories? You wrote a lot of songs. You've been with the other musicians, about Yogi's inspiration and guidance to the other musicians.
Oh, yeah.
Or yourself.
Well, yeah, he was constantly doing that. Back in 1974, we had a band called the Khalsa String Band. And it was about 8-9 people. And we actually went on tour across the country. And we would have the local ashrams would set up a concert for us. And we ended that tour in Española right before solstice, so we could go to solstice. And the day after I arrived in New Mexico, my son was born. So it was serendipitous all the way around. But he used to meet with us, the band, he would meet with the Khalsa String Band. Because one of the things we do is we would play songs in English, and then we'd usually play one or two shabads. And so he was kind of directing us. He was saying, well, after this song, you should do this shabad. And, or he'd say, I mean, so it was almost like we would have a rehearsal with him as the director. And so this one time, somebody was sitting behind the harmonium, and because we would switch instruments or switch what we were doing depending on the song or the and so he said, play this show, but I can't even remember the show it right now. It's one of the common ones, like Ikar Das, maybe. And I would normally play stuff on the guitar. I mean, I know how to play harmonium, and I would play harmonium. But I hadn't learned that shove it on the harmonium. So I sit behind the harmonium, and everybody starts playing. Like there's another harmonium they're playing, and everybody's playing their instruments. And I just sit there and sing along. He goes, stop, stop, what are you doing? Liftar, what are you doing? I said, nothing. And he goes, why aren't you playing? I said, I don't know this one on the harmonium. He said, you. God, for people who weren't around him, God bless you. You missed such a great thing, but he would do this thing like, you're the greatest idiot that was ever born in the history of the world. And he would just put it in one little facial expression or one little, he goes, you idiot. You've played that shabbat more times than you have hairs on your head. So I assumed he meant in my past incarnation. So we started playing, and I just started playing, and I played it perfect. I just played it. He came here one time to Atlanta to the ashram, and he has a poem he wrote about his song, Wawa, about his dog. Did I say song? He had a dog named Wawa. And this dog was this majestic little Highland Terrier, which they're not big, but they're very fierce. I think they were bred to go in burrows and bring out big animals or something. And so he took over as Yogi G's guardian. He was very serious about it. And he apparently was a very old soul, and all, you know, he was on his last incarnation. Sometimes you just mess up one thing and you might have to go back as an animal temporarily to finish out something. And so Wawa was serving Yogi G. And he wrote this beautiful song about him. And so some other people put it to music, but they made it sound like a drinking song from a bar. It was really not appropriate. So when he got here, he was like, Liftar, you need to put this song to music and do it right. And he tells me this at 11 at night. And he said, have it for me 8 a.m. first thing. So I had to go in the room, and I was up till 3:30, 4, putting this to music, getting the music right. And then I get up and I'm out there at 8. He doesn't come out till about 11. So, but that's not the point. The point is he gave me a job, a duty, and it's for me. It's not for him. Everybody gets this wrong. Everybody does it from their ego, like, he told these people to do ba 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 to serve him. No. He gave it for you. You want it, take it. If you don't want it, don't take it. So he gave me the job. I did the job. And he really liked it. And I can't remember off the top of my head. Yes, I wrote another song for somebody asked him what meditate, because when someone has a baby, they're supposed to have someone who helps the mother for 40 days so the mother can stay in the bedroom And it's called the 40-day Savitar, the person who helps them. And so someone said, sir, what should the 40-day Savitar, the one who's helping the mother and the baby, what should they meditate on? And he said, have Liftar write a song. And here's the line, and he gave me one line. God's child is born, his flower is born. And that's, and then I wrote the rest of the song from that. So
a beautiful song. Very
other,
beautiful.
You know, he used to bring musicians up on the stage with him, and he would tell us to sing. And he brought me up one time. Well, he brought several of us. And he said, Liftar, make up a song right now on the spot. Well, behind him on the stage, across the stage, they had the saying of that solstice, like each solstice would have a saying and it would be painted across the back of the stage. So that year it was, we are God, celebrate God, I think. Anyway, so I'm sitting kind of looking at him and I can see that. And so I start playing some music and I just start singing those words. And then I think I added in something to it. But when I started singing, everybody in the audience started laughing because they could see what I was doing, but he didn't see what I was doing. The other time, we were doing tantric back when he used to do it in person. And it was outdoors at winter solstice in Florida. And it was, I am thine in mind myself, Wahe Guru. And we started trying to chant it and we couldn't chant it. And the far right group was too far away from the left side and they couldn't hear each other and they couldn't keep it together. So he said, Liftar, come up here. You got 5 minutes to put a tune to this. So I just sat on the back of the stage, put a tune, and then we played it live for the tantric, played live music. And that's the one they use. I am thine in mind myself, Wahe Guru, hum me hum, tu me tu. And that night we recorded it sitting up on the stage with three or four of us playing instruments, and that's the recording they still use this day. But yeah, it's just lots of musicians have this kind of thing where he would inspire them or direct them or give them things to do. And then these things would not exist if he hadn't done it. There's just songs that wouldn't exist.
I'm going to play Mike Crosswind's, your version of it for the break. Is there anything you want to say about that before we go out?
This is his poem. And it's his poem about being the teacher, where you can't be a friend, you can't be a buddy. It's a very lonely existence of oneness, but you're still in a human form and you still have all of the human. You still love people, you still have to deal, you still have emotions, you still, and yet at the same time you have to be in that excellent oneness, or else you can't serve, you can't serve and finish your purpose. It's a very powerful poem.
Waiguru. So it's about 4 minutes. We're going to do that. Everybody needs to go to the bathroom or stretch your legs. Now's a good time.
Yeah. don't know why it should. There is nothing so bad, but everything is sad. I do just to do, can be good or bad too. Who is pure, who has sinned? One is caught in one's own crosswind.
So welcome back, everybody. Someone was asking to get that music somewhere. We'll find it if it's not readily available. Somehow we can get it. It's on my phone. It's an old phone of mine. We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Okay, so as promised. So, I mean, I think we talked a little bit about yesterday. I shared my impression. I know Bhutesh Singh shared, Ruby, Arjinder Kaur, on other webinars, we shared our sense of Yogi's magnanimous, majestic personality. And my hunch is that those accusations that are coming against him are just way, way, way below what he might even aspire for it. But just to add the icing to the cake here, look, here are some of the things that he did. These are some examples of his sheer genius, thinking out of the box, original work. He was teaching us, and someone was remarking to me this yesterday, in the early days, we didn't really distinguish between Sikh Dharma, which Yogi always called it a lifestyle, it's not a religion, and the 3HO, you know, healthy, happy, holy part. And so he was teaching us a holistic message, not so much geared towards merchandising. You see a lot of merchandising these days, level one, level two, level three, a level, you know, buy this product, buy that book, buy this, la, la, la. So we weren't really there. In fact, Lipkar and I, you know, we put our lives on the line. We said, we want to make a world of justice, peace. We want to bring this Aquarian age in, even if it kills us. We don't care. But we're not here for setting up a shop. Anyway, so Yogi Ji, though he lived, you know, in the beginning of KRI, and, I just want to say the first point of about 50 here is that he started a movement. A movement, it's a yoga movement, it's a Kundalini yoga movement, it's a healthy, happy, holy movement. And he married the values and the Rubani and the mantras of Sikh Dharma with yoga teachings that he knew. Next point, he gave us hundreds and hundreds of kriyas. And that's with losing his yoga books. You know, the airlines, they lost his books. So that's a story in itself, where all these kriyas came from. He gave us countless dietary prescriptions. You can find a lot of that in Dr. Dharma's book, Food as Medicine. Where did this stuff come from? I mean, how did he know all this stuff? I'm not going to answer that question. I don't think I know. The Grace of God movement, he started from scratch, and we saw there was a need. So we started it. So, you know, woman is the grace of God. He started White Tantric Yoga with us. We had no clue. We needed it very badly. He gave it to us. Satnam Rasayan came in rather later. Some people are really very big on Satnam Rasayan. And so that's another teaching here, just out of the blue. Guru for the Aquarian Age, we talked about the concept. Then networking, he was such a networker. He's so social. You know, he would be at the airport, right, making new friends. But, you know, he sought out and befriended hundreds of spiritual leaders, never mind ordinary folk. But he looked for these people, some of them quite reclusive, you know. He would look out for the head of the Hare Krishna movement, who was really quite hostile. You know, it's all Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna or the door. But Yogi Ji would try and meet this guy, invited him to come to the, I think, the 75 solstice. You know, he would meet all kinds of folks, including popes, you know, and archbishops. And he met with presidents. I think he met a couple of US presidents. And he maintained friendships in Punjab, which became very polarized in the 1980s. And people were, you know, either on the government side or they on the separatist side or on the Khalistan side. And he had friends on both sides. He was trying to counsel them to meet in the middle and to stop the human rights abuses. So, which is a dangerous position, because then people on both sides will suspect you. But he did that. That's what he did. 1985, he created a peace prayer day to bring in at solstice people of all different religions and no religion at all to share our common vision for peace. Just out of the blue, he did that. And you know, the University of Toronto, from the start of the Iraq War, took that model. We started Peace Week. And without Yogiji's example, we would never have Peace Week. In 95, he played a significant role in the World Sikh Conference after about, God, you know, 12, 14 years of the bloodshed in Punjab. A conference came together, Sikhs from all over the world came, and Yogiji played an important role there. And then again, you know, there was this group of Sikhs, very brave, if you read about them, called the Namdaris, who have been considered black sheep of the Sikh community for many years. What did Yogiji do? He reached out. He reached out to those guys and gave them center stage and tried to help to make a bridge toward those guys. Administratively, so I've covered teaching, networking. Administratively, well, he created the Healthy, Happy, Holy organization in 1969. Chuck, he thought that his first student thought that it sounded kind of funny, kind of hokey, but look what happened. Healthy, Happy, Holy organization. In 1970, the next year, the hippies have been doing solstices, the Celts have been doing solstices, and some of the hippie festivals were modeled on Celtic or Hopi customs. But by 70, Yogi Bhajan started our own solstice with no drugs. And it was a summer solstice, then we started winter solstice. So out of the blue, he did that. In 72, I believe, he started the Kundalini Research Institute, which continues today. organizing. There's a little bit of research, but mostly organizing teachings, publishing teachings. And if you want to publish something, they will fact check it to see it's correct and then give it their sign of approval. There's the International Teachers Association, started in 1993. He liked the initials of it, which basically go Ikta, in Punjabi, Ikta means unity. So his aspiration was obviously the teachers stick together, don't divide. The Sikh Dharma Ministry was started in 73. I mean, give him credit. In Punjab, there isn't really a ministry per se, especially if there's no women in that ministry. You can be called a Gyani. Just this year, they started in the Gyani school where you can go for a degree in religion. They started accepting women. But look, Yogiji was doing that in 73, saying, look, if you're a solid teacher of mine, you're getting up early in the morning, you're doing all these Sikh mantras, keeping your hair, you're not taking drugs, you know, be a minister, be a lighthouse. So he gave us a platform. I think in 75, he started the Khalsa Council, the administrative body, but he said, you know, I could be gone anytime. And he wanted us to be ready to be able to look after ourselves. Khalsa Women's Camps, first they called what, Ladies Camps, and then eventually called Khalsa Women's Training Camps, started in 75. Very powerful institution, very powerful place for women to come and not only learn, you know, grace of God, but to learn martial arts, to learn family psychology, to learn how to shoot a gun, and develop self-esteem, develop camaraderie, develop sisterhood. And so that goes on, been reduced in schedule and time, but still goes on. Office of the BISOP started in 73. There's this one kid, 15 years old, just soaked up Yogiji's teachings. And so much so, I'm on a bit of a tear about, subliminal racism that very hard in the West for a Caucasian to really come to grips with. But this guy, Dale Singh, first he was called, or Dale Sklar, he just leapt over that boundary. He picked up the brown language, he picked up the Punjabi. And Guruji, when he came back from India, he gave him the title Baisab, a religious administrator, a head religious administrator, just about at the same level as Yogiji. And he was brilliant. He passed a couple of years later, and then we had a couple more Baisabs. We still have one. But Yogiji started that out of the blue to create some balance, a counterbalance to himself. Since 71, since his yatra, his group excursion to India, he's maintained cordial, polite, friendly relationships with the chief administrative body of Sikh Dharma called the SGPC. You know, we've been out there. We've got stuff. We've made prasad with pani. We don't hardly speak Punjabi. You know, we've got the women ministers. We have different flags. There are different reasons we could get pushed out. But Yogiji made a point of keeping friendships going. And I remember he invited the Jatadar of the Anandpur Sahib to LA for a few days. Well, I think he pushed out of his job for being too feminist, but he brought him to the West. He supported him, Professor Manjeet Singh, and so on. Children's schooling in India, my God, you know, we're still getting the blowback from that. But it was a very brave and original idea to send our children to India to learn Indian culture, to learn Punjabi, and also to allow us, some of us quite crazy, to work out our own issues with our families, our spouses, and all that, without the children feeling all the pain and the chaos of that. Miri Piri Academy, finally we had our own school in 97. And thanks to Kulbir Singh. Kulbir Singh doesn't get a lot of credit, but he's Yogiji's younger son. He did a lot of that work getting that together. And so God bless Kulbir Singh. And his whole family, you know, Ranbir Singh and Kamaljeet, can't be easy, you know. We basically took over their dad, you know, and all his affections. He was advisor to family businesses. We started businesses around 71 because, well, a lot of us couldn't get jobs, you know. Nobody was going to hire a long-haired person those days. But we started our own businesses, Yogi Tea, Apollo Security, Golden Temple Bakery, Soothing Touch, Brass Beds, Golden, Sunshine Brass Beds, Yoga West. And so he was advising all these businesses, and well, he had a degree in economics, and a lot of these businesses really took off. And so thanks to him there. There's a whole section here on renewal, because when he came, Well, this is really a backwater of St. Norma. We had a lot of immigrants in the UK, somewhat in Canada.
Birfatta Singh.
Yeah.
You forgot about all the restaurants.
Oh, the restaurants. Yeah.
Nationwide. Well,
tell us about the restaurants.
We had probably 20 of them around the country at one time. And they were vegetarian restaurants, and we'd play our music and have our food, give them mung beans and rice. Really beautiful thing. And mainly when people moved into an ashram that had a restaurant, that's where they would work, and it would give everybody a job and ability to do a lot of seva all at the same time. Really beautiful.
Well,
those all kind of went away after, I don't know, in the 90s or something.
Somewhere earlier than that. I remember I was in Ottawa, I was talking about the Ottawa restaurant a while ago. And I think maybe like this was 73, 74. I think, you know, all of Ottawa at the time, there might've been 100 vegetarians who were trying to manage a restaurant. We didn't go very long. You know, we were picking up on what other people were doing elsewhere, but you know, maybe ours was the shortest lived restaurant. In Toronto, there was a snack bar. The Golden Temple Conscious Food was a health food store with a snack bar. But same principle as what I was saying, it provided jobs, and we got to play our music and share our vision, and sometimes we got yoga students out of it. It's true. I don't think there's one left. But you know, I was corresponding with Guru Bachchan Singh in Albuquerque, and they just started a restaurant. His wife started the Bachchan Car, and they call it Mata G's.
Yeah.
Mata G's. So it's a pun on words, like Mata G is Mata Guru Bachchan. And on the recipe, on the menu, they've got potent potatoes. Yeah.
Oh,
that was one
yeah.
of our key recipes. I thought we need to have a restaurant when they call the potent potato. You know, with totally, you know, prescribed dietary recipes. But, you know, they're keeping that recipe alive over there. I think they got the mung beans and rice. God bless them, and shout out to Albuquerque and the Guru Bachchans. Well, thank you. Thank you, Lupita. That is a very important chapter. Next chapter, renewal. Because basically, I mean, it's a very, I mean, some, you know, some racism, some Caucasian racism is subliminal, and some is just bloody overt in your face. And so if you were a brown-skinned Sikh coming to Canada, U.S., UK, forget about mainland Europe, and you wanted to get a job, a lot of times what the first thing you gotta do is cut off your hair and get a turban. And that's to get rid of your turban and cut off your hair. And that's what a lot of people felt they had to do. And so Yogi came and you know, he confronted that and actually used us as discussion points and said, you know, these dummies, we can do it, you can do it. And so, you know, there were some Punjabis hated us for that, and some actually, you know, rather liked us, and we were able to teach their children. So, so there was a lot of boozing and cutting hair and tying hair up into nets, and the Yogiji did his best to confront that and to bring people back to their roots, back to their spiritual path. I know Liptar Singh was part of a tour that went up to BC that did that work. He was talking about his trip, hopefully catching that ferry. And I know they worked and they tried, I think, to forget about turbans, just hand out head covers at one of the gurdwaras. I think the Akali Singh Sabha, the big gurdwara in Vancouver. Boy, the communists, the Naxalites came and they had a fist fight right at the doorsteps of the gurdwara. But that's all what Yogiji was doing. He said, don't fight back, let them hit you. And so God bless, there were a few pieces of bloodshed there. That's part of the mission too. Personally, you tell this story, Liptar Singh. You tell the story about when you named the ashram, your ashram after Yogiji. What happened?
We named our ashram, our Bhajan Singh Khalsa Yogi Ashram, or I think something like that. And we get this letter, it goes... Would you please, this is another one of his voices. So I can do the voice because I've been there when he does it. He's doing this instead of like chopping your head off. Would you please consider changing the name of your ashram to Guru Ram Dass Ashram? Thank you. That was it. It was like there was no big explanation or anything. I knew why, but so we changed it.
Oh, we loved him so much. Remember when I came, we had a song. My first teacher, she would sing the song with Cosmic Tuning, Divine Union with Yuji, Yogi Ji, who could know what life would be without life, breath of life, something like that it goes. Anyway, but this is all glorifying him, but he didn't care for that. He said, Guru Guru Wahi Guru, Guru Ram Dass Guru, go to Guru Ram Dass, don't go to me. And so he didn't allow any ashram or any enterprise to be named after him. And neither did he initiate anybody. That was the big thing. You know, you have a swami, you have a guru, you have initiation. No way. He said, if you can initiate yourself, you're not worth initiating. So he was all about self-initiation. Panchpradan, Panchpradan, Panchepave Darge Man. That's in the Japji Sar. Then the arts. We were talking about his relationship with the musicians. And my God, the beautiful music that came out in the early years and still coming out from Pre-HO. And some of the musicians, you know, the second generation, carrying on that tradition. But the musicians from that generation, Liptar, Vrdas Singh, Krishna Kaur, Singh Kaur, Guru Singh, Waiguru Kaur, Mata Mandir Singh, Don Cooper, Guru Shabbat Singh, Satkarpar Kaur, Guru Prem Singh, and I probably left a few people out, but those are the ones that come to my mind. Well, there were two Guru Shabbat, right? One left and one is still with us.
Yeah.
So that is huge. You know, he was not a great musician. There's still the recording of him singing We Are the People of Love, pretty out of key, but, with a lot of love. And, that was him singing that beautiful song and making new verses as he went along. Two books there are of his poetry, one, The Theme of Love. Wait.
That's what the gurus would do. That's what Guru Nanak especially would do. He would sing the teachings. So that song you're talking about, it's on the 30th anniversary CD. Again, we can probably make it available if you'll figure out how to give people somewhere to connect with you maybe. And then if you've got it, I have it if you don't have it. Anyway, they were at his birthday. And he just starts singing, and the band, who was just playing, I don't know what they were playing, just starts joining in, and it ends up being a song. And that, at the end, he says, are we the people of love? Let us people love today. That was the first time that had ever been sung. So that got then turned into a thing on its own. But he in that song, he's teaching, just like Guru Nanak would have done, but he's doing it in our language. I really recommend everybody hear this song. It's just really awesome. And if you want to hear modern Guru Nanak, this is it. Because he didn't think of any of it ahead of time. He's just flowing. And it happens to be set to music, which is what Guru Nanak would do. He would have Mardana there playing. Very cool.
Yeah, it's We Are the People of Love. Maybe you can't find it on YouTube, but just bug us, hug us, get us to help you with it, and we'll be happy to do that. It's really a timeless and very inspired piece from way early on. And he wrote poetry. He wrote English poetry, some of which we put to music, like you're saying, Wawa and My Crossroads, which we listened to in the intermission. So very, lends itself very well to music. But he also wrote in Punjabi in his own language, and he made a point of getting that translated. They gave that job to Guru Kasing, and they made a really beautiful job of it. And Yogaji said, I remember when he published it, this is not a book. Didn't say what it was, but it was a very inspired piece. And once again, he was just poking us a little bit when he came out in 95 or something. He was basically poking us again to do our best to get a little bit into the Punjabi language. Because he knew we didn't want to do it very much, but hopefully, you know, if he can give us some poetry and make it really easy. Anyway, so the Pope provoked in front, you know. And then there's the visual artist, Seva Singh. There's a whole chapter in his bio about Seva Singh and Yogiji's working with him and his wife, Seva Kaur, Guru Kiran Kaur in Phoenix, Sivika Thakkar, bless her heart, she did the illustrations for the bio. She's in Los Angeles, originally from Italy. Ray Mandarkar, who did the backdrops of a lot of those solstices, the artwork on the stage there. Jyot Singh, with all his beautiful jewelry and swords that he made. Suraj Kaur, I think she did stained glass. And again, there's probably lots of folks that I'm just leaving out, who is an inspiration too, and continues to be an inspiration too. So there's the arts, his role in the arts. Then there's the healing arts, his inspiration and guidance to medical doctors. We've quite a few medical doctors just in the first generation. Chiropractors, I think he started the whole chiropractic association. We meet, I think, once or twice a year. A massage therapist, naturopaths, acupuncturists, and so on. And he also gave inspiration and guidance to the researchers. You know, we have Satbir Singh, originally from Toronto, now at Harvard University. He had guidance and inspiration from Yogiji. David Chanahop Kulsa in San Diego, same thing. They had ongoing correspondence and guidance from Yogiji as they did their groundbreaking work. Because, you know, at the beginning, we had no data. What they call data. We had no scientific research backing us up. Now we do. And I'm very grateful in Toronto, one of my students, Dr. Farah Jindani, did some of that and did a really great study on the effects of Kundalini yoga to certain Kriyas. She got some from Shanti Shantikar with a bit of help from Satbir Singh and put it through about 60 people. Changed their lives totally. And we documented it. You know, what do you call it? Statistically hard, soft, measures of it. It's subjective and objective measures. And those are really global level study, a world class study. And so Yogiji is the heart of all of that. And so any one of these things could probably get you a Wikipedia article, but he was genius on all these different levels. And I'll pass it on to this over again to Lipkar Singh, who saw more of this firsthand than I did.
Yeah, there's a particular story I want to tell. Because it captures the unbelievable scope of Yogiji's existence. I said before I was the regional director and we would go on these trips and I would go with Yogiji. So Trinidad, when we would visit Trinidad, it was a source of the most amazing concentrated amazing events that would happen in one place. I mean, there's stories after stories of just amazing things that would happen in Trinidad. But the one that I want to tell you is we would be there and then the local people would set up events. So they would set up a talk and we would go there and he would talk and give a kriya or whatever. So this one day, we all get in the cars and we drive way out in the country. And we're just not near any town or anything. Well, I mean, there's a little town, but not near any of the big towns. And I was on setting up his seat duty. So I would run in ahead. I would have his skin and whatever I had. I can't remember. So as we pull up, I jump out of the car and I run into the place first. And it's a little church. And it's this little cute little church that's probably, I don't know, 15 feet across, and the pews are all a little small, and there's a centered aisle. And so I'm at the front looking back to the door where he's going to come in. So I'm in front of the church, everybody's facing me, and I can see this whole thing happen. So I put his scan down, and then I'm standing there looking, and he comes in. And he walks really slow, and as he walks past each one of the pews where the people are sitting, they just dive out of their seat on and grab his feet. And I mean, they were diving. Because Trinidad has, let's see, I think it's a third, I might have the numbers wrong, but anyway, it's like 40% Black African, because they used it to bring slaves. And then about 40% from India, and they would bring Indians there back in the 17, 1800s for, they weren't slaves, but they were something. Anyway, whatever. So it's this really unique society there where it's a mixture of all these things. And then there's like 10% Chinese. But the neighborhoods where the Indians live, they play shabads. What do they call them? Not shabads, but they're kirtan.
Buttons.
Over loudspeakers, just like they do in India. So if you're walking through this neighborhood, you close your eyes, you're in India. You just think you're in India. So there's a lot of the Indian culture still there. So as he comes down this aisle, the people are just diving over each other and out and grabbing his feet and putting their head on him. And he's starting to just get tears in his eyes, and it's like walking through molasses because they won't let go and they're all grabbing. And he slowly makes his way to the front. And I looked at Sat Simran, his traveling secretary, because she would go with him everywhere and she would see everything. And this happened a few times in Trinidad where I'd look at her and say, have you ever seen anything like this? And she said, no, this is something new. So he finally makes to the front, and then he gives his talk normal and gives the meditation, and we go. And then either later that night or the next day, he's giving another talk. And he gets this long, far off look in his eye, and he says, and yesterday we went to a church, and there I saw friends of mine from 10,000 and 100,000 years. Old friends of mine who came to say goodbye. And when he said that, I totally understood what had been going on when I saw it. His reaction to it, their reaction, which obviously they didn't know consciously, but that they had been there just after thousands of years and incarnations to see him and say goodbye. So, and there was another time, I'll say it real quick. On this one trip we did there, there were these young girls to young ladies from about 14 to about 20, 21 years old. And there was maybe 5, 6, 7 of them. And they would come to every class. They would come visit in the hotel during when he would kind of have visiting hours where people could come and see him and hang out at the hotel. And every single thing that he did there, they were there. And what their thing was, every word he would say or every sentence, they would laugh. And they would laugh in this ringing bells like Krishna's gopis. I don't even know how to describe it. They're just really honest, just delighted by him. Just, and I mean everything he would say. So we'd be walking down the hallway in the hotel on the way to go teach or something, and they would all be around him. He would say, "It's a beautiful day." They'd all laugh. "Oh my God, look at this person here." "What time do we have to be there?" We started calling them the laughing squad. And I asked Sat Simran, and I said, "Have you ever seen anything like this?" And she's like, "No." This is just like unbelievable, just this amazing thing. And then that never happened again. Like the other trips, it didn't happen. It was just that thing for that time. Anyway, do we have a schedule here? What's our?
Actually, you know, we just had a request. Can you read your chat? Up Top Singh from Trinidad, read a request.
From Trinidad?
Yeah, you remember Up Top Singh? He was probably your host there.
Up Top's here?
Yeah. And he made you a request. He's asking for a special story. You see that?
I see where he said, "There's blue light on my glasses."
Further down, further, quite a bit further down.
Okay. Yep, that doesn't work.
I can read it.
Hang on, I got it. I don't see it. Read it.
Tell you to talk about the time Yogaji went into the little hut late at night when he cried. Remember that?
I think that's what he meant.
Okay.
Because he was crying and it was this little bitty church thing.
Yeah.
Otherwise, yeah. I don't know.
So many stories in Trinidad.
Of a hut. It's different from that story.
Yeah. Carry on. I mean, I've gone through, you know, if you want to take off on any aspect of the genius. Oh, Aftab says, "That's it. You got it. You nailed it."
Okay.
Good. Good.
So there's another story about my experience and my journey that has everything to do with all of this. I can't remember the date now, but I think it was early 2000s, 15 years ago or something. I was driving in my car. I've written about this because I wrote a song about it. And I suddenly saw the one. I saw that everything was one. And it just became reality to me. It's not like, oh, I had an experience while I was meditating, or I became it. It became. And all of the things I've ever read about it, all pain and sorrow instantly vanish. All self-doubt, negative self-talk, separation vanished. It's the thing that is talked about in the Siddhi Guru Granth Sahib. Yogiji talked about it. You call it, I don't know what to call it, enlightenment or whatever you call it. I was driving in my car. I wasn't even meditating. And everything just kind of went into oneness. And I said, holy shit, it really is all one. Because to that point, it was a concept. It was just an intellectual concept that I was working on and meditating on and reading it over and over in the Siddhi Guru Granth Sahib. And for about 6 months, I was almost mute because I suddenly went into the reality that there is no other. There is no you listening to me. There's no me talking. There's no other. There's only one in all of its forms, playing all the parts, talking to itself like a puppet, talking like, this is what's going on. Hi, how are you? I'm fine. Good. That's good to see you today. Good to see you. It's really me talking to myself with my hand puppets. So I was in this dumbstruck state where I was like, why would I talk to any, there's no one to talk to. There's no other. There's not a person there. There's not a, and so I went through this whole process of, well, my teacher's been there. What did he do? Well, my teacher talked. Okay, so I'll talk and I'll pretend that I think you're a real person and I'm talking to you. And what else did he do? He taught. Because it's very tempting then to just go away. Just like, I'm going in. I'm not coming out. There's nothing out there. Goodbye. I'm a hermit. And but this is where he is a teacher, and the levels of his effect as a teacher, his influence as a teacher, his value of what he had to teach. You just cannot put your mind around. It's basically, it's infinite. So I was like, what did he do? He taught. He tried to pass it along. He had the experience. He tried to pass it along. You don't get that from a scammer. You don't get it from a jokester. You don't get it from anything except the real open channel that sees it that way. It's not possible. It's not possible for a whale to do ballet on the stage. It's not possible for Yogiji to not be in his infinity. If you think he wasn't, it's your problem. It's your concept. And there's all this, he wasn't perfect, he was perfect, blah, 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 which to me is insane talk. First of all, everything's perfect because it is what God wants it to be as the play. So it's a stupid even way to talk about anything. But the depth, the facets, the things that, like, I would never have known what to do without him after I had this experience. And I'm telling you, this experience was like getting hit by a car. It smacked the hell out of me. It wiped out my view of the world. It was like you took away my entire concepts of everything. There was just one. And you think, okay, you got where you wanted to go, and that's true. But there's something after that, finishing the karma, finishing the life, going through all the things you still have to go through till the day you take your last breath. I'd have never thought of this ahead of time. I would have had no idea how to even think about it or what I was going to need when it happened, until it happened. And there he was. He was already there. He had already been through it. And he was saying and showing by his life, no, here's what you do. It's not a big thing. You talk, you act normal, you pretend everything's real, and you teach and you try to transmit this experience in this oneness to others. So the first person who puts themselves in their place, in my mind and my experience, I'll listen to your opinion about him. And that's never going to happen, can't happen. So I know what he is. I know what he, the universe is, he encompasses. And there's no, nothing there but infinity. There's nothing there but Seva. There's nothing there but pure flow of energy. Period.
Vaheguru, you just celebrated an anniversary, didn't you?
Yes, we just had our 49th wedding anniversary on Solstice Day.
We got celebrated with two other couples. You want to tell that story?
25 couples. 1971. That's the same solstice where he talked about us being in the trucks and being killed. That's the same one. I had been in Atlanta for 1 year as head of an ashram, and it was a lot of hippies. It was the hippie days. And I was a really cool, you know, I was the yoga teacher, and I had long hair and a beard.
And a guitar.
And I was kind of like, I didn't understand certain things because the way I was brought up and, you know, have humility about yourself. And so just these women were after me everywhere. I won't go into how I know, but I know they would tell me. And I was like, I'm not here for that. I don't want to do women. I want to do yoga. And so when I got to Solstice, I said, sir, you've got to get me a wife, because just for protection, like, I didn't even think about it any further than that, except, yeah, I guess you're going to get married anyway. I need it right now. I need protection. And so he goes, hey, call Shakti and get this and ask them and see who they think. And so he started like getting everybody involved. And Shakti Parwa said, oh, there's this beautiful lady and young lady in Washington, D.C. And so they called her, and that's Liftar Kaur. She wasn't even there. So he said, he gets her on the phone. He said, do you love me? And she said, yes, sir. And he said, get on the next plane. You're going to get married. So everybody there helped her get a little dress made and get ready. And somebody made her two little rings out of beads. So we didn't have rings or anything. She flew out. I met her on one day. The next day we got our license. And then the third day we had the wedding. And the same thing happened to the Grijivans of New York. Not like how that happened, but they hadn't met before. So they met there, and he kind of put them together. Gurukas also got married, Guruka Singhankar. They already knew each other. They were already together. And Daya Singhankar and Gurpreets. So we know of four couples still together. There are maybe others, but they're just not around anymore. But a couple of solstices there were 25, 28 weddings. He was like, get going, let's get going, get everybody married, get started. He didn't want to wait around.
Marriage is the carriage to infinity, he said.
Yeah. And I just saw a thing by him. One of his sayings that he talked about, you think marriage is this state of bliss, or I don't know how he put it, but he said, no, it's like a constant negotiation, constant give and take, constant dealing with your stuff and their stuff. And that's what it is. And I once taught a class at summer solstice on marriage, and they never asked me to do it again because I said, just pick somebody and marry them, and then don't give up. Pick the person sitting next to you, get married. You know, that's a little too hardcore for the average person. They want to hear, oh, you know, you do this and that, and everybody's different. I'm not saying anything. Like, my son and his wife went to school together in India and really kind of fell in love there, and they're fantastic. And, you know, so it's not everything's, everyone is different. Everyone's got their own path, their own story, how they do it. And so, but yeah, to me, marriage was another one of my yogic practices. That's how I always looked at it. It's sadhana, yoga, marriage, and the duties that come with marriage, taking care of your family and all that stuff.
Vaheguru. You want to, there's a beautiful song, The Khalsa Way. You want to talk about how that came to you? People don't sing that one so much, but I love it. And it's got Yogiji in it as well.
Yeah, you know, I don't know why I hadn't thought of it. I guess I can just stick these up on YouTube. That's the easiest.
I've done, you know, but the volume isn't very great. Remember I put together a few of those?
That's right. Yeah.
But the volume is not so great. If you can do a cranked up version with the volume. But tell the story about it if you can. How'd you write that?
I think I was just sitting in the... This room I'm in is our sadhana room in Gurdwara. And I don't remember exactly. After morning sadhana, I was sitting there with my guitar. And a lot of times music will just come to me, usually from the guitar. Like, I don't think of the music and play it. My hands play the tune, and then I hear it. And then I start taking it and making it into, and that was just in the era of Song of the Khalsa and, you know, martial spirit and getting through the challenges and the, and Yogiji would say things like in 1972 solstice, he said, we're very much in danger right now of a nuclear holocaust. So we had the first a con pot that we'd ever had, but we had no city guru or anything, or we weren't that far along yet. So what he did was he had 24 hours long ekankars. So he had two or three people scheduled to always be doing it 24 hours a day, all during the solstice. And that particular year, he said it was for that reason, because there's another thing that happened when we were in New York one time with him, and the Khalsa string band was there and he was there, so we must have played music and then he spoke or something. But we were outdoors in an outdoor park. It was kind of a foggy night, and all the lights of the city made the sky glow red in the fog. And he was talking, and he said, look at that. See that red glow? That's what the whole world will look like if we have a nuclear holocaust. And the only thing that's keeping that from happening is the Golden Temple, where they're reading 24 hours a day, Sri Guru Granth Sahib, reading the Bani's 24 hours a day. And if it ever falls within 11 years, I think he said, I might have this wrong, but anyway, within some years, the world will go down in a nuclear holocaust. So that energy of the Golden Temple is keeping the balance of peace on the earth. So then I started thinking about the Golden Temple and the shape of it and everything. And if you haven't seen it, go look at a top view of the Golden Temple. Just look it up online. And so there's the square around where you walk around when you come in. And then there's a walkway that goes up into the temple, which sits in the middle. So you can say it's an atom, and that's the nucleus. And then the people that walk around on the outside, prakarma, they're the electrons. So it's like a big atom. And it's also like a yoni and a lingam, which is the universal sign of Waiguru. It's just got all these energetic and representative energies and the way it's designed and what goes on there. It's a fascinating thing, the Golden Temple, Harimandir. So that was that.
Speaking of temples, do you have any recollection of the Temple of Steel?
Not a lot, just that you would talk about it a little bit. Someday it's going to be there, and people would say, how are you going to pay for it? He said, don't worry, it'll pay for itself. So there's a lot of energy around it, but I guess for now it's waiting.
For those of you who haven't heard, the Temple of Steel, it's a vision Yogiji had that up in Ram Dass Puri, where the summer solstice is, that there'll be a pyramid-shaped temple, and there's a architect in France called Gurhan Singh who designed that. And certainly something for the future, but a very visionary concept to have a place. And everybody said, well, there'll be processions coming from Santa Fe, thousands and thousands of people one day. And that's the nature of Yogiji. And you would think 500 years ahead, think way ahead and plan and teach for that, not for today, but for the future.
Well, he did say the technology to build it doesn't even exist yet, which gives you a little clue. Because what it is, it's the pyramid, but just the corners. So it's not a solid pyramid. It's the corners of the pyramid. And then in the middle of the pyramid is a 40-foot meditating yogi. And then underneath, it's an inverted pyramid down into the ground with living quarters. Because he said someday there might be some really bad things happen and people can go there and have a place to stay while the rough times play out and they can survive there. Yeah, I mean, just it's like somebody walking around with the virus. He just incredible ideas and amazing visions and teachings just fall off of him like skin cells falling off as he walks by. I mean, it's just unending, amazing, infinite, just incredible.
We're running near the end. Does anybody have any questions they'd like answered before we wrap it up? Somebody sent a text. They said there's a sarovar as well with the steel, Temple of Steel. Maybe maybe we're done. We've been 2.5 hours. Can you sing for us?
I guess I could. Let me
Yes, please sing.
I have to move things around a little bit. when you first started and you were talking about all the differences people have, and there's an old song from the 60s, folk song. And it was it talked about every country and every how they didn't like each other. And at the end it goes, Italians hate Yugoslavs, South Africans hate the Dutch, and I don't like anybody very much. You remember that?
The Kingston Trio, yeah, I remember.
Yeah, yeah. I used to love that song. Let me see here. I can't do serious. Sorry. Can you hear it?
Yep.
Valium and Mary Jane and LSD. Whoa, sorry. Capo. Valium and Mary Jane and LSD have wrecked your brain. Now you're going quite insane. Kundalini yoga is the way for you to fix it, G. It will fix your brain so you can see across the universe. Om Namo Guru Dev Namo. Yeah, it will really change your world. It will really change your world. Things will never seem the same. Double coffee, morning news, and all the stressful things you choose, they elevate your cortisol across the universe. But if you choose to meditate and breathe a lot, then you'll feel great. Then your mind will elevate across the universe. Om Namo. To feel real neat, you eat bad fat, what's up with that? You'll be wide as the universe. Tune your life, relax your mind, treat yourself well, and you will find happiness and peace of mind will shower from the universe. Om Namo Guru Dev. See a brand new world. You'll be a brand new guy or girl.
Vaheguru. I did get one request. Before we finish, maybe a long time center, somebody wanted to know about your famous performance of the Song of the Khalsa in Amritsar in 1995. You said she thought it must have been a very unifying experience. What was your experience?
Well, anybody who doesn't have time can leave, so I'll just tell the story too. We had a big trip to India for the thing, and about 100 people went. And I put in to get my what do you call it when they let you visa. So I put my visa request in and it never came. The whole group left. And I was like, okay, well, I didn't make it. So Yogiji calls Gurjot Singh from Virginia, D.C., and he says, where the hell's Livtar? He said, I don't know, I'll call him. He didn't know anything about it. He called, I said, well, I put my visa in and, you know, a month ago and they never did it. And I kept calling them and they didn't do it. So he told Yogiji that. He said, you get him on a plane here, I'll kill you. And then I'll bring you back to life and kill you again. And, you know, his thing that he would do. And, so Gurjot, the DC ashram had a good relationship with the Indian embassy there. So they got it put through in one night. And so I got on the plane the next day. And the reason this is important is that I arrived that night and the day that I got there is when this thing happened.
May I just explain what the thing is?
The thing where we went on stage and recited Song of the Khalsa.
And the context of that?
I'll tell you that part in a second.
Okay.
But everybody there was sick. They had this some kind of flu or something. They all got it. And part of it was you lose your voice. The next day after this event happened that I'm about to tell you about, my voice went completely dead, couldn't even whisper, zero voice. If I had gone on the trip on the same day as everybody, I would have not, this would have never happened. It's just another one of those, if you think life is random, you're not getting it. So what it was is a bunch of Sikh leaders from all over the world came and had this big conference thing, and it was at the Golden Temple complex, kind of off to one side. They had a big open space. It had a roof but no sides, so it was like a semi outdoor thing, and they had a stage at one end, and had to be 1,000, 2,000, I don't remember, but a lot of people. And, you know, the head of the SGPC and the head of this and head of that, and they were all there. And what he had planned to do was have us American Sikhs, not American Sikhs, us non-Indian Sikhs, because we were there from Europe, Australia, South America. We were from all over the world. And what he wanted to do is have us all come up, say, Vaheguru Ji Ka Khalsa, Vaheguru Ji Fateh, I'm from Brazil. And then each person would just do that, just to get into their brain that Sikhism isn't a thing in the Punjab. That, you know, he was trying to open their minds to the possibility. But what happened is I came up about fourth and it just, he stopped right there and he goes, "Liftar, sing him Song of the Khalsa." So they brought my guitar up and I started singing. He goes, "Stop, stop." He said, "Just say it." So I would just say one line and then he would translate it into Punjabi. So we went line by line through, and in Daughters of the Khalsa, he stopped and he got this kind of pained look on his face. And I thought he was having a heart attack because he had already been having heart problems. What it turned out was he was about to cry and he was trying to stop from crying. But anyway, we went through the whole thing and some lines, the whole crowd would do Bole Sonihal Satsirikal. And it was just this massive major thing where he was able to show them what they had, that they had this incredible gift. If you just look at it the right way, that it can spread from the Punjab, it can spread outside of Indians, it can spread, because they thought of it kind of like their own little club, their own little thing. So I was told this later by Guru Tej Singh of Akal Security, who now lives in Singapore. He was with Yogiji, he was just like on his security. He said all the way back to where they were staying, and all that night, Yogiji talked about it. He said, "That was so cool. That was so great. If Guru Gobind Singh personally came with Krishna, with Brahma and Shiva, and personally said, 'I'll do anything for you you want if you just don't have this experience that you just had,' he said, 'I wouldn't take it. It's better than anything that could happen in the universe.'" He just went on and on. He thought that was the best thing ever. And that's what it was. It was just, you can't say it in words. You can't talk them into it. They had to see that Guru Gobind Singh's message through Guru Nanak had gotten out, had become a worldwide thing that it was meant to be. And he just loved that.
I think also part of the story, the reason he wanted to go line by line, is they weren't getting the English that you were singing.
Correct.
When he did that. Would you like, I found it here, would you like, I don't think there's a way of putting your hands up. I don't know how it works, but I can play this if folks are interested. We said we might go to a four that lasts about 6 minutes. What do you think about that?
You've got the...
Oh, we got hands going up. Hands going up. Okay, here we go. Right?
Can't hear. I mean, I can't understand it. It's just noise. Oh, Maybe we can put it up online. And yeah, I can't understand the word.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe we can put it on the line somewhere or something.
Okay, anyway, we tried. But thanks to City of AC who recorded it.
Someone said we were called the Sikh Beatles. That wasn't UK, that was in India. We went to India, me and Gurshevit and Gurdas. And Yogiji was trying to get the Indians to let us play for the school children. We'd go to schools and play. They never let us play for anybody above second grade. Oh my God, they're so funny. They didn't want us messing with the older kids. I don't know what. But anyway, they said, you have to bill yourselves as the Sikh Beatles. So that's what we were called when we went on that trip.
Hmm. You could be corrupting their morals is what they were thinking.
I guess. I don't know. We're not playing the first graders. It was pretty funny.
Oh, yeah.
That's all right. They need it.
Yeah. A lot of growth needed on both sides of that cultural divide. Waguru. Were there any other questions? Let's see what the chats are doing now. Yeah. Okay, we'll figure it out. We have the recording. We'll figure out a way to get it to you. It's there. And it's, it's written up in the biography, but the recording's around. Obviously, I've got it. You can share it somehow. I think we're out of questions. I think you people have really feasted on your memories. There's a lot of satisfied, grateful remarks we're getting. Thanks a lot for showing up. Can we do long time son? What do you think?
What's that?
Can we do the long time son?
Oh. Let's do it like this. May the long-time sunshine upon all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on. May the long-time sunshine upon all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on. May the long-time sunshine upon all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on, guide your way on, guide your way on. I have a little prayer too. Formless in every form, boundless and yet bound by the power of love. Unseen and yet seen through thy creation. Give us strength to carry on, and bring peace to the world. May we see the one in everyone, so we may become one with the one. Peace to all, life to all. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you from Rwanda and Russia and everywhere you come from. God bless you all. God bless you all. Hope to see you again tomorrow. This has been recorded. We'll send it to you. You can share it. God bless you. Thank you so much, Liptar Singh.
Waheguru.
Your voice survived. Congratulations on
that. Barely.
Grace of you, God bless. Thank you again. God bless you all. Satnam.